If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 531. Nietzsche Among the Aliens, with guest Daniel Coffeen, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Monday, October 29th, 2018. What you'll hear over the next hour is a conversation that took place on live radio yesterday with author Daniel Coffeen. He is one of the Zero Books stable of authors, and it was Doug Lane who made the introduction. So thanks to Doug Lane for putting me in touch with Daniel, and thanks to everybody who supports the Sea Realm Podcast in one way or another. For many, it is by subscribing to the Sea Realm Vault Podcast, which is a, I used to say second weekly podcast, but now it's basically the only weekly podcast I do, and the main Sea Realm Podcast is an occasional podcast. Comes out, I guess, on average about once a month. So most of my podcasting is for a pretty small audience now. It is the people who pay $7 a month via Patreon to access the majority of my podcasting work. And even if you don't support me on Patreon, it's worth taking a look at my Patreon feed from time to time, because I do put stuff up there like blog posts that are unlocked. They are available for anybody to view. So my Patreon is patreon.com/KMO. Alrighty, the conversation with Daniel Coffeen is pretty self-explanatory, so here it is.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
You're listening to WOOL Black Sheep Radio on 91.5 FM, Sea Realm Radio with KMO.
Hello, Bellows Falls, and all you people in the future listening on the internet to the podcast version of this, Sea Realm Radio. I am KMO, and I am looking at a whiteboard which advises me that on the air I should be happy, because happiness exudes happiness. So I'm very happy to be talking to you. And also, I'm happy to be talking with Daniel Coffeen. Daniel, you there?
I am indeed here. Hey.
Awesome. You are joining us from San Francisco, yes?
I am indeed, yes.
All righty. I'd say I was just there, but I was just on that coast, I think would be more accurate. It's a long trip from Los Angeles, where I was, up to San Francisco.
I think, you know, coming from the East Coast myself, California is it's okay just to say I was near there. You know, it's one big mass of California, you know.
You lived in Brooklyn, right?
No, I grew up in, I was in Manhattan, and I grew up in Westchester.
Okay, Manhattan, the fancy island.
Yeah, no, we were not the fancy ones.
Actually, Brooklyn's pretty fancy these days.
It is. I don't recognize Brooklyn. You know, growing up, we never went out to Brooklyn. You know, it was confusing. I didn't know what that, so now whenever I'm home and I end up in Brooklyn, I got a map with me. I don't know where I'm going. It's very, very confusing to me. I don't know where the cabs are. The whole thing throws me off.
Well, we can talk about how GPS and our phones keep us from learning new places in a minute. First, I need to read a couple of things. Public service announcements, they're called. And I had to sort through a bunch of them because so many of them were just too darn political and too darn topical for my taste. I'm just really kind of irritated with politics and political discussion in general these days. So I'm going to tell folks that there is a pie-making class that they should take. The next
Maple
stage
Picard's
on,
project.
No corn syrup. Wine and coffee will be served up. Wow, I'm hungry now. Alrighty, close that one. And the boy who plays on the Buddhas of Bamayan. Stone Church Films, a program
November
of Stone
16th,
Church
Arts.
The boy who plays on the Buddhas of Bamayan, which tells the story of an 8-year-old refugee boy called Mir who lives on a cave among the ruins. It is also the story of the more than 25 years that Afghanistan has been at war. Over 2 million civilians have been killed during that time, and how, in March 2001, the ruling Taliban destroyed the tallest stone statues in the world, the Buddhas of Bamayan. And I have not seen that film. What I'm about to say is in no way a comment on the film or the Stone Church, but it strikes me
that if you could summon up the Buddha and say, hey, Buddha, there's some statues of you that people are really awfully attached to, and there's a group of people who propose to blow it up, the Buddha would have said, yeah, blow it up. That's you don't want to be attached to statues, particularly of me. So while I'm reading, I'm going to read one more thing. This is the Zero Books Culture and Society and Politics website bio for my guest, Daniel Coffeen. Daniel has a PhD in rhetoric from UC Berkeley, where he was a lecturer for many years, lecturer with a capital L. In addition, he taught graduate seminars in critical theory at the San Francisco Art Institute. Never considering himself an academic, Daniel works independently, writing about contemporary art, film, language, Deleuze, perception, uni, also capitalized, don't know what that is, capitalism, emergent shapes, pleasure, new media, death, and tequila. He has appeared on numerous podcasts, including The Partially Examined Life, Diet Soap, and Zero Squared. And you're actually on the radio right now, but I'll put this up as a podcast tomorrow so we can add the Sea Realm podcast to that list. Daniel Coffeen, welcome to Sea Realm Radio.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's hilarious hearing the bio read. So, it's uni.
Uni.
You know, like raw sea urchin.
Oh, okay. Okay. I was thrown off by the capital U.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And the L is capitalized lecturer because people get really worked up in the academy, right? If I say I was professor, well, no, I wasn't a professor track. It actually, it's, you know, it's these internal bureaucratic distinctions. So depending on my audience, I use different titles. But
gotcha.
Ergo the capital.
Well, you are here because I've been talking to Doug Lane for many years, and people who are in the know realize that when I mentioned the Diet Soap podcast, that means you and Doug go way back as well, because the Diet Soap is it's been out of production for a few years now.
Yeah.
And you're a published author with Zero Books, and Doug is the publisher there.
Yep. Not a coincidence.
Not a coincidence, right? And Doug introduced me to you because I asked him – well, he's always sending me recommendations that I interview this Zero Books or that Zero Books author. And often they send a book and I don't read it. But, you know, I read enough about them, maybe listen to their appearance on the Zero Books podcast to hold a conversation with them. But I wrote to him and I said, hey, I have been assigned the task of adding – the character of Friedrich Nietzsche to this comic strip that I write and draw. And I don't know a whole lot about Nietzsche. So who do you suggest I talk to? And he said, well, you should talk to Daniel Coffeen. So why should I talk to you about Nietzsche, other than the fact that I think you probably know something about him and I want to hear what you have to say?
Yeah. It's funny. It keeps coming up. I'm actually going to work with Thaddeus Russell, too, on putting together a Nietzsche course for his university.
You're welcome to plug that, by the way.
You say what? You say you listen to that?
I said you are welcome to plug that project. You said his university.
Oh yeah. Well, I don't know the details yet, so I don't know. There's nothing quite yet to plug. That
okay.
Russell on Unregistered Podcast is starting an online sort of alternate university called Renegade University. Right now, it's just some. It's going to become more robust over time. Y'all can check that out. I support his project emphatically, enthusiastically. And then we're talking different things. And so Nietzsche, you know, generally speaking, I don't, you know, I studied this thing called rhetoric at UC Berkeley, and I just sort of read what I wanted to read, you know, and I sort of eliminate any possibility I could have for an academic job because I don't really have an expert field. I don't really believe in expert dumb. You know, I believe in sort of relentless amateur status, sort of weave together according to whatever logic you want. But Nietzsche, I just got so fixated on, I read everything, you know, multiple times, and sort of penetrated my way of going, starting in college. So Nietzsche's one area. So I was like, well, you know, I can talk about Nietzsche. Nietzsche's just something I know. I live and breathe it. You know, it's not like I'm not a Nietzsche scholar. I have Nietzsche disease. I have Nietzsche virus.
Have you ever lived in a non-English speaking country?
I tried living in Europe. I tried living in France, Paris.
When was that?
It only lasted a few months because it was miserable. Why do you ask?
Well, Let me ask you one more question. When was that? What was the year or years?
That was 1991.
Okay. So, yes, you have lived in a non-English speaking country in the pre-World Wide Web days.
Yes. Yes.
I have as well. I lived in Japan a couple times. And when you are living in a non-English speaking country before, you know, the web was on your phone, you would end up reading some really unlikely selections just because they happen to be available to you.
Totally, yeah.
So,
oh, my God, yeah.
I read Thus Spake Zarathustra for just that reason. I wasn't pursuing anything. You know, I mean, I had taken philosophy classes in college, but I wasn't really interested in Nietzsche. And this book just happened to fall into my hands. And I read it at a time in my life when I probably wasn't really prepared for it. And it was just kind of a curiosity. But there was some colorful language and some quotes that stuck with me. But for the most part, I don't think it really gave me much insight. You know, my 20-something-year-old reading of it now hasn't left me with much insight into Nietzsche's, you know, his view on life. I've gotten a lot more just with, you know, by conversations with people quite recently about him. But I ask you into this forum to talk about Nietzsche because I'm going to introduce him as a character into a weekly comic strip, which I hope the listeners at this point know that I do. It is published every Sunday. It is called Geb. That's G-E-B-B. The website is geb.io. And it's a story of aliens who live underground at the South Pole. And they do what aliens are supposed to do in our, you know, contemporary mythology. They fly around in their flying saucers. They abduct people. They whisk them off to some remote location for humiliating and painful medical experiments that often involved anal probing. And this is a ridiculous thing for aliens to do. And the aliens doing it realize that it is not only ridiculous and pointless, but it is actually harmful. They're actually hurting people. And they're also aware that there's a lot of good they could be doing given the technology at their disposal. But the decision of whether or not to help humanity with the energy crisis or with the mass extinction that we're causing on this planet or with the climate chaos that we are engendering by cranking up the carbon content of the atmosphere, all of those decisions are above their pay grade. They don't get to decide, you know, whether or not humans get any help from extraterrestrials. They just have to do their job. And so they are alienated aliens. They don't want to do this work, but they have to. So they distract themselves and they get lost in drugs and TV and food and video games and bickering with one another and, you know, adopting personas, which they have lifted, you know, human personas, which they have lifted from popular culture. And into this mix, for reasons that will not be explained to them, they are going to be, they're going to get a roommate in the form of a clone of Friedrich Nietzsche. So how is Friedrich Nietzsche going to respond to these aliens who have such amazing technology at their disposal and who have amazing breadth of experience themselves, but are completely alienated and basically subdued in their personality and distracted by trivia?
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much how Nietzsche sees modernity, you know, and, you know, definitely modern Europe. But even going back, you know, his big cutoff is the rise of the Jews, right? Rise of Judeo-Christianity, rise of the one God, you know, supplanting the Greco-Romans. And he sees that as a sort of slave revolt and the beginning of the sort of rise, what he calls the herd, you know, and his critique of Judeo-Christianity is that they're nihilists, right? They're self-loathing, they loathe life, and at the best of them is that they loathe life. The rest of them are just the herd. They're just the masses that just have poor instincts towards nothing, towards, you know, watching TV and eating their drugs and having no true delectation in life itself, right? So they're they'll
good word that
pleasure,
by the way.
It's not real pleasure.
Delectation. I like that word.
Yeah, it's a good word, right? Yeah, you know, savoring of one's, you know, what one imbibes. So you know that it works well because then that's sort of his view of life, you know. I mean, he has a particular disdain for modern Europe, Germans and anti-Semites in particular. But, you know, all of sort of modernity and all of, again, modernity being the last 2,000 years, sort of fits your description of your aliens, right?
So he's got a particular – go ahead.
Yeah. As you said, the question is then, what does he do, right? I mean, I suppose that's what you're wondering. How does he handle all these people?
Right. And I'm told that he was quite the charmer, that he was quite adept socially.
Yeah, I don't know about this. You know, the little I understand about him, you know, I'm not a big biography guy, is that he was, you know, he was chronically ill. You know, he's a real kvetch, you know. I mean, the Breivin books are hilarious. You know, he's so lit up. He's just oozing off the page, right? Just bouncing off the page. So, you know, it never reads like anything in the history of philosophy. Right, it's just jumping and exclamation points and asides, and you know, he'll be giving his, you know, in a book, Genealogy of Morals, probably most sustained argument. So Zarathustra to me is sort of an outlier book, and people love it, but there are great things about it. I can't tell if it's a total failure, but in Genealogy of Morals, you know, he's giving his argument that, you know, about the slave revolt, that if you trace morality back, you know, it's not God-given, right? It's genealogical. It has a history. It's an historical creation, and it comes from this will of the slaves who overthrew the Greco-Romans. So he's giving this whole elaborate argument, and in the middle, it just stops, and he says, you know, foul air, what can't I stand? What is the thing that repulses me? The stench of some ill-constituted soul. And he's repulsed by the kind of, you know, petty, weak, resentful mob. And then he goes back to his argument. Right? So he's filled with these sort of diatribes and these outbursts. So socially adept, I'm not quite sure, you know, how that fits into this particular society of alienated aliens.
You've mentioned that he's a particular critic of Judeo-Christianity. And as I understand it, he doesn't much care for Christianity because in terms of what's good in life, the Roman pagans really had it. You know, they knew that what's good is to have money and to have political power and prestige and to have sex and to eat good food and, you know, have some slaves and maybe own some land. And all of this stuff, all of this stuff is good. And the slaves can't have that. So Christianity, which was the religion of slaves in the Roman Empire, turns virtue into vice and vice into virtue. And, you know, it turns the lack of all of the good stuff in life into evidence that you are living properly.
Exactly. Yes. Totally. Yeah. I mean, the argument, not, you know, the risk of being pedantic, you know, his
– Oh, be pedantic. Go for it.
You know, for the Greeks and the Romans, it's not that they're not – it's not hedonism that interests Nietzsche. Right, it's he says for the Greco-Romans, they define good as themselves. So it's not that it's good to eat and good to have sex and good to indulge. It's that they themselves are what is good. They are noble and hence inherently just good. And the things that are not them aren't evil; they're bad. Right? They make you sick. They're weak. They don't fuel and serve life. And then the Judeo-Christians come along and they juxtapose evil with good, right? And they make people fundamentally responsible. So they make the bird of prey responsible for wanting to kill the little lamb, right? But Nietzsche would say, no, the bird of prey, that's just what it does. You can't hold it responsible. So the Judeo-Christianity invents this thing called the ego, the soul, and God. They're all part of the same sort of operation, same sort of machine. And it allows them to hold the nobleman and just any individual responsible for their actions rather than those people just being what they are, them just exuding their will and their will to power, however it happens to go. Right? So they posit that there's an agent inside of you, right? That's either good or evil. And for the Greco-Romans, it was them themselves, and it is their bodies and the things they're eating. But they weren't. It's not hedonism, right? It's only hedonism from a Christian perspective, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. You mentioned in passing, and it wasn't in this last exchange, but the one before, the notion of resentment. And that is something that Nietzsche would definitely come down hard on. Talk about resentment.
Yeah, I mean, resentment, you know, for some reason in the book, I don't know, you know, I tried Nietzsche in German. My German never got good enough because he writes fancy German. So it's always referred to as ressentiment. They always use the French word. I don't know why. But it is resentment. He says that's the birth. The resentment is what leads to morality. And it's the slaves just seething, right? It's Schadenfreude. Right? They want to bring down the strong. Right? They just can't stand their state. They can't just embrace their own state. And so they want others to suffer. So he says, you know, he's throughout Genealogy of Morals, he reads, you know, various sermons, you know, and you see just the resentment, the hate-filled rage. You know, we'll watch you burn in hell, you sinners, you know, as your skin roasts and we smell and hear your screams, right? It's a sort of a sadistic resentment, right, of just wanting to tear down anything that aspires beyond the herd, beyond the everyday, beyond the weak banality. So that's sort of it. Resentment is key to him, because sort of the key figure that we call the Übermensch, the overman, seeks to overcome. It's one of the things he seeks to overcome.
And sort of related to resentment is the attachment to implied contracts. Like, you know, we used to talk about this thing and I thought I knew your position and now you're saying something different and I'm, you know, I'm kind of put out by that. And Nietzsche would say, well, Nietzsche would look down on that sort of thing.
Well, you know, no, I mean, he, I'm not so sure about that. You know, there are, you know, the contract, the idea of the contract, especially on the social level, really comes out of the Enlightenment, right? It comes out of Hobbes and the sort of agreements we're all coming to these terms to not slaughter each other. Nietzsche just has a different genealogy, right? A different understanding of how we enter the social, right? So for Nietzsche, we didn't enter the social as these rational beings, which is how Hobbes depicts it, right? Hobbes says we're in the state of nature. It's nasty, brutish, and short. But you know what? It's unpleasant. So I'll agree not to kill you. You agree not to kill me. Right? And we enter into these agreements, right, as we've made this sort of rational decision. For Nietzsche, the beasts of prey are sort of roaming, you know, the beasts of prey being these human beasts. And they're roaming around, and some of them are bored. And they start beating themselves, whipping themselves as a kind of canvas. Their own life becomes a canvas. He considers it an artistic endeavor to create a human being capable of making a promise, capable of being continuous across time, right? Because their instinct is just to live moment to moment. But it becomes uninteresting, and that the promise makes life more interesting. So he claims that the social comes out of an artistic moment, that there were these certain artists who they're the first artists, and the first thing they created was a human being capable of a promise. And their first canvas was their body, and they literally had to beat themselves to be capable of it. And they did it because it was interesting. So it's a very different genealogy of the contract. So, you know, I don't know if that quite addresses what you're looking for here.
Well, it's very interesting because largely I'm just channeling the last person that I talked to about this topic. And you are, to some extent, contradicting that person, but in other places, amplifying what they said to me. So it's quite interesting to me whether you say, yeah, that's exactly right, or maybe not quite. Both of those are very influential and useful to me.
Good, good, good. I mean, everyone's going to have their own Nietzsche, of course. You know, he wrote a ton, and, you know, he refused to write like a philosophical system, right? So he's writing these short little bits, these aphorisms, these little tiny sort of quasi essays, these paragraphs. He's jumping all around. Genealogy of Morals is pretty much a sustained argument, more or less. But that's really the only place he does that. So the point is, there's lots of ways in, you know, and he's sort of like the Buddha. I love the Buddha statues. You know, it's one of Nietzsche's. Echoes a lot of, you know, that sentiment. And he's like, you know, you want to be my student? Spit on me and walk away. You know, I don't have a disciple. Don't follow me. There's no such thing as a follower. And the greatest respect you can show me as a student is to reject me. Go away. Leave me alone. so, there's inevitably going to be many different Nietzsches.
Well, I'm in an interesting position in that I haven't spent so much time with him on the page that I'm motivated, you know, to bring him to life as a fictional character. It's just sort of been presented to me as a challenge. So,
Okay.
So but here
my,
I go.
If I was going to read anything, but I would, if I were you, I would buy the. I already have it. It's the vintage. I guess that's Random House. I don't know. It's vintage Random House version of the Genealogy of Morals with Ecce Homo, and both. Translated by Walter Kaufman, and it comes together. And I think those are his two best books to really get a sense of him. So the Genealogy is the most thorough and just sort of laying out his argument. It sort of runs through everything. And then Ecce Homo comes at the very end of his life, and it's a sort of autobiography. The title of the chapters are Why I Am So Wise, Why I Am So Clever, and Why I Write Such Good Books. And it's hilarious. You just get a great sense for his shtick. And it's called Ecce Homo. Right, Ecce Homo is that's the title of his biography. And Ecce Homo is what Pontius Pilate says when he calls out Jesus in front of the Jews. Right, he says, "Ecce Homo, behold the man. This is your guy." Sort of ironically, and so Nietzsche calls his own autobiography Ecce Homo. Right, so and he calls himself the Antichrist. So you know, you get his bombast. You know, really, really, and his ironic bombast, I think, in Ecce Homo. So if I was looking to sink my teeth into what Nietzsche's shtick is, that's what I'd recommend.
That's the crash course in his personality.
I think so, yeah. I mean, Ecce Homo just kills me. It's so funny. You can skip the whole ending of it where he goes through all the different books and why they're brilliant. You know, I mean, I don't know. I just flipped open just for the goof and Why I Am So Wise, chapter 6, and it begins, "Freedom from resentment, enlightenment about resentment. Who knows how much I am ultimately indebted in this respect also to my protracted sickness." But he claims that he was sick and that his sickness gave him the ability to understand health. And it's not because it's just the opposite. It's because when he was sick, and he was sick all the time, he was dyspeptic and he was miserable and doing every possible treatment under the sun. And it's that he claims that he was never sick at bottom. He was never as woe is me. I know personally when I get sick, I feel pathetic. You know, I just want to throw in the towel. This is it. I'm sick at bottom. I'm filled with resentment and self-hatred and loathing and, you know, but Nietzsche's like, I was never sick at bottom. Sickness just gave me a greater sense of joy. You know, he talks about vomiting phlegm for days on end. But that it's his sickness was a sort of a key aspect of his being, you know, part of his identity. So, yeah, Ecce Homo, it's hilarious. And it goes through his diet, goes through the things he'd eat. You know, I mean, that's one of my favorite sections. You know, he talks about he talks about books and food indiscriminately. They blur for him. So something like British food and British writing, because it's bloated. It makes you feel terrible. It's heavy. It's hard to digest. He talks about you should eat a big meal. Eat a big meal. Fill your entire stomach. Never drink coffee. Coffee makes you sick all day long. Just drink some tea.
Oh, that'll be funny because the characters are all coffee addicts.
Oh, right. Yeah. And he does not believe in coffee. So his whole thing on diet, it's very particular, you know, but at the same time, he's never going to bash you for drinking coffee because he says, you know, a hint from my morality, know the size of your own stomach. Right. So
I was in Los Angeles last weekend and, I was really looking forward to having a good burrito in Los Angeles. Because I live in Vermont, in southeastern Vermont, and, you know, no offense to Vermonters, I'm not from here. You know, burritos are not really, they're not king around here. I would have to drive quite a ways to find an acceptable burrito, you know, much less a good burrito. And it just didn't come up. I mean, I was with people in L.A., and we were never really at restaurants that served a credible burrito, so I never had one. But, you know, in anticipating going to the West Coast, you know, all the people I was going to interact with, all the things I was going to do, the thing that was kind of at the forefront of my mind is, I want to get a good burrito.
And it lets you down. You never got it.
I never got it, no. I mean, at one point, I suppose I could have, like, after a meal with other people, I could have struck out on my own and gone and eaten a burrito, but I wouldn't have been hungry. You know, it wouldn't have tasted as good.
I hear you. Well, you know, to follow this tangent a moment, it's not quite a tangent, San Francisco is ripe with burritos. So San Francisco is really the burrito town.
I believe you.
The taquerias on every corner, you know, are like when I was growing up in New York, like the Chinese restaurants. Sort of the worst one is kind of okay.
Last time I was in San Francisco, it was, I think it was 2013. And I walked from near the waterfront where I was staying to the Mission District, and I had a righteous burrito.
There you go. See? Yeah. See?
That was 5 years ago, though. I'm ready for my next big burrito.
Yeah, I won't drop ship you a, you know.
Ready for my next big burrito.
Yeah, I won't drop ship you a, you know, a burrito.
Well, no, it's got to be in the place, though, for sure.
Yeah. But the particularity of our foods, right? So Nietzsche is very particular, but he's never, it's going to be interesting for you, I think, to be writing this, because he's never, he doesn't want other people to follow him. He doesn't believe in code. So if he doesn't drink coffee, it doesn't mean you shouldn't drink coffee. You know, so it's, what he'll constantly bash people for is not even being worth his time, not even being interesting. Right? And he said, you got to choose your enemies well. You know, and if he writes about you, it's because he cares about you, because he thinks you're interesting, you're worth talking about. Everyone else is just, again, a phrase he uses a lot is the herd. You know, just the masses that just go one way or another, right? That are no interest. Yeah. But he has respect for, like, the nutty priests who, you know, self-flagellate and, you know, really fall down and, you know, with the word of God and speak in tongues. And he's like, they might be the leaders of the slave revolt, but they are in fact the leaders of a slave revolt, and they won. They overthrew the Romans. So he has a kind of respect for them, even if he wants a different way of going. And so he's complicated that way, right? He'll relish a good enemy, right? So it's not what you believe, it's how you believe it that interests him. If that makes sense.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
not what you say, but how you say it.
Yeah. And he wants. You know, it's a herd that bothers him. So he always imagines himself on the mountaintop and wants other people alone on their mountaintops. And that's his notion of a community. And they might be his enemy. But that's, he thinks an enemy is, there's no real difference between an enemy and a friend for him, right? They're just people who are strong and have their independent way of going. They're sure of themselves. They don't seek outside, affirmation. They affirm themselves. Affirmation is sort of the key to Nietzsche, right? He says the formula, you know, the formula for the good life, for forget his exact line. His formula for living well is amor fati, love faith, love everything that happens to you, everything, every cut, scrape, emotional wound, bruise, burp, everything that happens to you is the best possible thing. Wish it no other way. And that's his philosophy. And that Judeo-Christianity and various other religions are always trying to get out of this life, trying to not affirm, trying to negate. Something's wrong here. Don't be doing this. Do this. Wait for this. It's going to happen in the afterlife. If you do this, then good things will happen. He's like, no, the good is simply to affirm. It's an action. It's to affirm this life because there is no other life. So he's gonna fit in interesting.
So at this point, I need to say that you're listening to Sea Realm Radio on WOOL 91.5 FM in Bellows Falls. I am KMO, and I'm speaking with Daniel Coffin about Friedrich Nietzsche. And we're talking about it because I'm thinking about how I'm going to work Nietzsche as a character into this comic strip. And here's the thing that I'm struggling with right now. You mentioned how so much of Nietzsche's insight into human mentality came from his own bodily infirmity, his own sickness. You know, he spent so much time and such attention on his own physical discomforts that it really became almost indispensable in terms of, you know, an ingredient in his thought process. And the Nietzsche in this story won't be the original. This will be a recreation made by a mysterious alien entity. And this alien entity could create him with his physical infirmities or without them. And I'm wondering how you see Nietzsche waking up suddenly one day just hale and healthy.
You know, I think you could play it any way. So I think, yes, I think he wakes up totally healthy. He would just be kind of I know we talked about this a little bit in email, and I've been thinking about it. He affirms. So if he woke up without his sickness, I think he'd be ecstatic too. You know, because it's always – I think, you know, I like the idea in my own head of his relationship to his own sickness coming back. I kind of like him as a sort of dyspeptic character, you know, sort of holding forth and then having to burp, you know, excuse himself and never quite finding his flow, you know. Did you ever read The Confederacy of Dunces, John Kennedy Toole?
Way, way back. So, yes, but I don't remember it all that clearly.
The character of Ignatius Riley is a sort of bombastic, pompous, you know, hilarious sort of gargantuan character. Who's constantly having his valve open and close and getting, you know, his reflux, and he's constantly miserable.
It's coming back to me.
Yeah. To me, I kind of read Ignatius as a reading of Nietzsche.
Uh-huh.
And sort of how I pictured Nietzsche in everyday life, you know, just never quite fitting in, everyone thinking he's this freak, kind of constantly going off on everybody. I don't know in reality if that's how he was, you know. My guess is he's could be quite polite, and you know, but I prefer to imagine him as sort of more bombastic, with this kind of I don't know why him like belching as he's holding forth about resentment cracks me up, but that's how I choose to see him. If he woke up suddenly healthy, I could see him having this sort of ambivalent relationship to his newfound health, you know, sort of ecstatic, fundamentally ecstatic by it. But also, you know, secretly wishing, you know, secretly longing, feeling for his burp, waiting for his burp.
Well, if he wants to burp, I mean, that can be arranged. There are certainly substances he could imbibe. I think one of my strategies for comedy with him is that this is not the first Nietzsche clone that has been introduced into this base. He doesn't remember the experiences of the previous one, but some of the people there, some of the aliens, do remember the previous Nietzsche, and one of them didn't like him and may even have killed the previous one. So she knows all of his, you know, basic talking points and is utterly sick of them and repulsed by them. Like, I want to have her, you know, almost as soon as he comes to consciousness, like drag him up to the top of a mountain in Antarctica and say, you know, breathe in the mountain air, you freak. Get your fill of it.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, you know, I think it would work well. I think he, getting a little fun with his own sense of his bombast, you know, could work. You know, and I don't think he's ever going to be chummy with anybody.
Well, there's one character who's determinedly chummy with everybody, so we'll see how that goes. So why is it? I mean, your career and your educational career and path have been largely self-determined, largely idiosyncratic. Nietzsche is big for you, not because you were assigned him or, you know, you took you had a curriculum designed around, you know, familiarizing yourself with Nietzsche. What is it that from Nietzsche that has stuck with you and made him such an important point, you know, a character in your mental life?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think at first it was the thing that really got me excited was actually began for me before I read Nietzsche. It began for me in high school when I, you know, I was in public high school, but I'm in this nice little posh town up just north of Manhattan, and we happen to have a couple teachers who were, you know, actually good and avowed communists. And, you know, so I remember in my American history class reading this essay by a sort of left-wing historian, Gabriel Coco, on the creation of the USDA, right? And Coco argues that the creation of it happened in with complicity with the meat industry, right? That the government, it was this sort of corporate government alliance after the scandal of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle and a need to sort of help move meat, right? And give it the stamp of approval because people weren't buying it. And I loved this reversal, right? And I thought at first I was interested in history. And because it was a history class, but I realized as I became a history major as an undergraduate that I wasn't interested in history. I was interested in interesting, surprising readings of things. And so when I read Nietzsche, and all of a sudden he's making this great move in the genealogy of morals, that the Judeo-Christians are the nihilists and that and are just resentful, and that he, in affirming life after the death of God, is the anti-nihilist, right? So my first attraction to him was just this super deft sort of exhilaration of this keen interpretation that sort of completely reordered how I view the world. And then there's the particularity of his worldview, right? So there's sort of a two moments there for me. One, the first one being just this, his sort of interpretive acumen, his interpretive skill, just kind of just did it for me. That's what, that was my introduction to philosophy. It came through Foucault and Nietzsche and Derrida. These guys have just had these different readings of things. Things that I just took for granted, they suddenly gave me this very different view of. And then there's just Nietzsche's sort of, again, his radical affirmation. Just this, he's a real philosopher of joy, right? He is the philosopher of joy. And he positions joy over and against resentment and morality. Joy as an affirmation. This life, simply for the sake of this life, it needs no other justification. And again, that just sort of reoriented my whole sense of life, sense of what counts as a goal. I shifted from being very socially minded, politically minded, to a different kind of philosophy, and again, a philosophy of joy, just seeking to affirm myself, my people around me, rather than institutional change, rather than these sort of abstract, bureaucratic political engagements. I got interested just in the act of living joyfully. Not that I'm successful at all. I'm a pretty miserable guy. But, you know, I like the idea of being joyful. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, that's that is an answer to my question. I'm sure it's not complete, but, you know, we have more time left. I was laughing at much of what you were saying, but I had my microphone turned off because there's a train that was going right by the station here. So you might have been drowned out by a train whistle.
I don't want that.
Can you hear it? It's still going.
I cannot.
Well, when I asked and then I was quiet so that you could hear it, it stopped.
Spoiled again.
Yes. Local listeners, though, will know that this is a live show because they will hear the train first, you know, coming through the window, and then they'll hear it 8 seconds later over the radio.
Yeah, I love this whole live thing. I've done a lot of podcasts. I've never done a live one.
You know, it's rural Vermont, and people listening are either in Vermont or New Hampshire. I'm actually speaking to you from the radio station, which is on an island in the Connecticut River, which is the dividing line between Vermont and New Hampshire. So our station is in Vermont, technically. Our transmitter is on a mountain in New Hampshire, and the actual physical radio station is on an island between the two states.
Wow.
Yeah. Awesome. But I bring that all that up because more people will hear this as a podcast than are hearing it live.
Right.
Southern Vermont is rather sparsely populated. If you see it from the air, it is hard to distinguish from primeval forest. there are a few highways cut through it, but there are, I think, a little more than 600,000 people in the whole state, and most of them are up north near Burlington. So, you know, there's, I don't know how many, like 6 or 8 million people on the island of Manhattan alone. You know, they really pack them in tight there.
Yeah, they do.
So we've got a whole state with, far, far fewer people than just fits on one island in part of New York City.
It just sounds fantastic.
It's personally nice, and there's a lot to recommend it, I have to say. But if you are used to a variety of restaurants and social gatherings where you're not seeing the exact dozen people again and again, it's good to get out to the city from time to time.
Yeah. Well, the fact is, I'm approaching a man of a certain age, and I don't know how much I need restaurants and other people anymore. I think those days are behind me. Joyfully, affirmatively.
Well, if you enjoy walks in the woods, yeah, this would probably be the place for you.
Yeah.
We have no ocean, though.
The ocean. I'm a little addicted to the ocean. I will say Nietzsche loved going on walks. One of his great lines is never trust an idea that comes while seated. One walk, one afternoon, all in his head.
Well, that is very helpful because the characters in the comic strip live in a fairly – it's a big underground space, but underground spaces, by their very nature, are pretty closed in. And were he to walk to the surface, he would die rather quickly, it being Antarctica and all. So that will be a frustration for him for sure.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. I mean, I'd be like nature, like moving. Again, I don't picture him as very athletic. I'm not quite sure what these walks of his look like,
I'm going to ask you one more question about Nietzsche, and then we're going to branch out and just talk about stuff in general, because we're down to the last quarter hour. What's up with the crazy mustache?
Yeah, from what my understanding of the mustache is actually was later. That was kind of his sister's doing. So his last 10 years, supposedly, from what I understand, he couldn't really take care of himself. So he lived with his mother and his last bunch of years with his sister. And again, I'm not a real historian here, but my understanding is that she was married to sort of a leading German anti-Semite. And Nietzsche hated him. So Nietzsche went out of his way to sort of bash the anti-Semitic movements as really like the low below, like way below the Jews. I think she, supposedly the two of them, her and her husband, began sort of cutting up his writing and trying to make it more palatable to their cause. And she tried turning him into this genius with this big mustache. That's my understanding.
Because really if you go online and you just search for pictures of him, you'll find pictures of him with a fairly normal looking mustache. And then you'll find other pictures of him where, it's half his face is his mustache. It just leaps out. It's huge.
Yeah. Somewhere I've seen like a 2-second video clip. There's a small film of him somewhere.
Wow.
Yeah.
What can you glean from 2 seconds of motion?
He died in 1900. So he's super infirm. So he's like, I get a blanket in like a rocking chair or something. He just looks super frail. So not much.
And how old was he when he died?
I don't know. I want to say under 60, maybe 60.
Okay.
Something.
He didn't
something
die
like
super
maybe.
Young then.
No, he wasn't super young. No. And he stopped writing in, I guess, 1890. Last 10 years, he didn't really write, as far as I know.
So I'm just sitting here sort of scowling and nodding and then remembering, you're on the radio, so you need to talk.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, too. I purposely don't like reading biographies of people I like. I studied Wittgenstein in a seminar once, and the teacher was – didn't like very much, had us read this well-received biography of Wittgenstein. And I just came away from it. Wittgenstein was sort of this schnook, this sort of uptight guy constantly boxing his students' ears. I could never quite take his philosophy seriously after that. I just pictured this schnook. I didn't picture some great genius. I just pictured a guy who was really just kind of unpleasant. I really didn't have any desire to engage his philosophy, even though I love his philosophy. I won't write about Wittgenstein because I read that damn biography.
I've got sort of a similar thing going on with Immanuel Kant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, what are you doing reading Kant? Jeez.
Well, that was in grad school. I was definitely assigned. It was not not anything I would have chosen, but I did, you know, when I was a grad student, I taught undergraduate courses, and I didn't get to choose the books for those courses, so I taught the groundwork for the metaphysic of morals repeatedly. So
yeah,
you never know a text so well as when you teach it to other people. So
completely.
Yeah, so that one just, you know, by happenstance, my life path really got laid down pretty concretely. And then later I learned, you know, more of, you know, his personality. Like Kant thought that masturbation was worse than murder. So bit of a weirdo, kind of made it hard for me to take his other stuff seriously.
Yeah, exactly. I haven't read Nietzsche biographies. I mean, mostly what I get is from his own writings. He talks about himself a lot. And then, you know, the whole thing going crazy and all that, I sometimes believe it, sometimes I don't. I don't know if it matters to me. You know, the popular myth is it's syphilis or something and fell down in the street trying to protect the horse. I don't need any of that.
All right. So now we're down to 10 minutes. So let me give you the opportunity to just maybe say what your current preoccupations are. I'll give you a start and tell you that I've just come back from Politicon, and I am particularly sensitive to behavior of, I think, self-satisfied people on the, you know, what passes for the left in the United States mainstream. I am 50 years old. I have spent a lifetime really thinking of Republicans as the enemy. And if I were maybe 30, I might be voting Republican right now because I wouldn't have that history of, you know, remembering what the Republicans were like back in the 80s and the 90s. I'm just so turned off by the Democratic mainstream and by, you know, the so-called social justice warriors whom I mostly encounter on the internet.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, this came up a bunch with, you know, me and Thaddeus, maybe some of it off mic, in that I haven't followed the news since I was 19. I haven't read a newspaper, and I'm 50 myself. I haven't read a newspaper, listened to the news, voted, done any of these things, because I refuse to participate in a political system that is so explicitly bought and sold. I feel duped. I'm voting for you, but you can take money from anybody? Like, I don't understand. So I won't participate in the voting system until there is no private money allowed in campaigns. I just don't understand how people can participate. I literally don't understand. You're just choosing who. I have to follow who your donors are and see if I align with their corporate interests. It doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't make any sense to me that none of the things that I care about are even considered reasonable, right? How come we don't have a president who says, yeah, I'm going to cut our military budget by 75%. I'm going to build, you know, a thorough, you know, welfare system and make public education and healthcare free. I'm not saying I want all those things, but it seems a reasonable thing to suggest. How come no one even suggests it? I don't understand how our terms of the system got so hedged in by straight up explicit corporate ownership that to participate seems to me complicitness with interests that just are inherently against my own. So I have to feign ignorance. I just don't know. I don't know what's going on out there. Left, right. I imagined myself a lefty growing up. And then turned away from all that, not turning away from the some of the beliefs, but turning away from the mode, the dreariness, the bureaucracy, the sanctimony, the self-seriousness. And is really reading Nietzsche, beginning to believe in a politics of joy. I don't engage. I don't follow these things. I don't know. I know who the president is. It's hard not to know, but that's about all I know.
Well,
so I don't know.
Even on a total news blackout, you probably heard that in the primary contest, there was a senator from my home state of Vermont named Bernie Sanders who was running and did not take any corporate money and, you know, offered a clear alternative to the obvious bought and sold corporate packaged candidate. And it seems that the hostility remaining between the Clinton voters and the Sanders voters is fresher and hotter and even more raw than the antipathy between, you know, Clinton voters and Trump voters.
Yeah, again, that's something I wouldn't understand. I heard people talk about Bernie Sanders. I think I saw his face with, I couldn't believe his thick accents. It's like, well, you know, they elect people who talk and look like that. I'd be impressed. And a Jew, no less. I don't know. That made me squirm a little bit. Honestly, I'm going to get a little paranoid that they're going to come for us next, like in Pittsburgh. I know about the Pittsburgh thing because of my news, you know, my Twitter feed.
Yeah.
He seems exciting, but I don't understand the interest in, that Cole Clinton machine, you know, from people who claim, like you, I grew up in the Democratic Party, my family, and just assuming that they were the good guys. And then just seeing this unbelievable warmongering, free state tech liberalism thing, free market, you know, it's so repulsive to me. And so antithetical, right? They became kind of the Republicans I grew up with, you know, sort of like the big finance 80s Reagan era, you know, greed driven politicians. So yeah, I don't know. I'm afraid my response is not much help to you. I don't know. I don't know about I believe in ducking. I just want to duck and parry and wait for this whole thing to be over. You know, wait when I can get out of San Francisco after my kid graduates high school, run for the hills, I'll join you in Vermont. Try to unplug from this techno surveillance state and, you know, try to live with some peace until I, you know, become worm meat.
That's a good attitude. And, you know, I wasn't looking to you to, you know, articulate my own viewpoint for me. So you don't need to worry about, you know, not being of any help to me. Basically, the things that I say are just prompts to get you to, you know, say whatever is on your mind or, you know, maybe push your mind in a direction that it wasn't already going, but, you know, not necessarily a predetermined direction with a specific outcome in mind.
Well, it is interesting because, you know, so talking to you now, I talked to Thaddeus the other day, I talked to Doug a couple of weeks ago, and this same question comes up a lot. It's sort of the state of sort of political discussion in this country. So clearly it's of interest to people who I respect, people who are smart and thinking about things, right? And they're clearly running into something. My guess is, as you sort of set up your question, right? There's disconnect. Things have shifted. You're trying to make sense of a new sort of order of how political discussions are even framed, and so that's interesting to me. I'm just ignorant. You know.
Well, blissfully so, it sounds like.
Yeah. At least on this front. Yeah. I mean, I see. You know, I meet people and they. Old friends and stuff, and they have such angst. They'll talk about the president and something he's done, and they're shaking. Their bodies are, they've internalized this anxiety, and I feel for them. I understand being angry and all this stuff, but I don't know what that accomplishes. You know, like reading about things just to know them and feel anxious seems a weird thing. Like I try to read books and anything that make me feel joy or smarter, more interesting, or, you know, not things to make me more anxious.
Well, Daniel, we're down to about the last minute, so I would like to offer you the opportunity to tell people where they can find more of your work or really anything you want to say for the next minute.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I got to plug my book. I got to be good to zero books. And my book, which is all about critical creative thinking.
What's the title?
The Way of Things. Reading the Way of Things.
Reading the Way of Things. All righty.
And the colon is towards a new technology of making sense. It's very accessible. You know, I talk about movies and and martini glasses. I talk about some philosophers, but it's not academic at all.
All righty. And what's your Twitter handle?
It is DeCoffeine. Just so my name is DeCoffeine.
And that's like coffee with an N at the end.
Coffee with an N. Whenever I say that, people always say, one F? two F's, two E's. And my blog is Emphatic Umph.
Emphatic
U-M-P-H.
Umph. U-M-P-H. All right. Yeah. Well, Daniel Coffeen, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much. And I hope to read your book. It sounds great.
Great. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, to its old dimensions.
All right, we are near the end of another installment of the Sea Realm podcast. Something that Daniel mentioned in our conversation is that everybody's going to have their own Nietzsche. As I mentioned in the conversation, I have been talking to some other people, one person in particular whom I did not identify because she is not a public figure. I did share a recorded conversation with her on the Sea Realm Vault podcast, but even there I didn't identify her. But I think she was kind of sweet on her mental image of Nietzsche. So she imagined him as being possibly more socially skilled and debonair than Daniel Coffeen's Nietzsche. My Nietzsche is still coalescing and is highly mutable at this point. So if you want to have an influence on the formation of my Friedrich Nietzsche, you can get in touch with me. My email address is kmo@crealm.com. You can also reach me on Twitter, where my handle is K-A-Y-E-M-M-O. That's K-M-O spelled phonetically. And then there is the MeWe Sea Realm podcast discussion group, which is on MeWe.com. And the conversations that take place on that MeWe group often provide fodder for the Sea Realm Vault podcast. So you can really play an influential role in the direction that the Sea Realm podcast and the Sea Realm conversation takes going forward by lending your thoughts and your voice to that ongoing conversation over at MeWe.com. All right, that's just about the end of this episode of the podcast. There might be a podcast next week. I'm going to be interviewing the current Lieutenant Governor of Vermont, who is running for re-election. And I know that, you know, most of you listening don't live in Vermont and, you know, probably don't particularly care who the Lieutenant Governor is. So the content of that conversation will determine whether or not I put it out as a podcast. If it seems like if the conversation seems like it would be of interest to the larger Sea Realm audience, I will share it. And if it seems pretty provincial, then I'll just leave it as a live radio broadcast and not put it on the internet. The guy that I'll be interviewing, his name is David Zuckerman, and I've interviewed him before. He's a pretty cool guy. I hope that someday he will be the governor of this state. All right, that is all. Thanks for listening. Stay well.